So, Christopher.
Shayna.
Can I just take a moment, you know, before anybody's on and listening to us, to kvetch a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. Just keep your voice down because we don't want anyone to overhear us.
Okay. So, just between you and me, I have been railing at the weather lately. I'm good with snow. I'm good with rain. Really not an invitation for the two of them to happen simultaneously. That's all I'm going to say about that. Yeah. That's it. The end.
Welcome to What in God's Name. She is Shayna Appel.
And he's Chris Owen.
We are recasting the narrative of our shared common life together using the lenses of philosophy and theology.
Getting ourselves past the binaries that dominate so much of the conversation in our public square. Those would be the binaries of politics and economics, which, while helpful in some contexts, do not get us into a discussion that addresses human flourishing.
If you are listening and wondering, which side are these people on, I would like to gently suggest that you've taken the cheese. We're trying to get beyond those kinds of binaries. It's only natural, though, to approach any kind of media and say, okay.
I do it. I'm laughing because I do it all the time. I do it all the time.
You can learn more about our show by checking out the trailer on the homepage of our website, whatingods.com. We do ask you to subscribe to What in God's Name on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review. We do live in an algorithm world, and we are trying to say hello to those algorithms.
We're massaging the algorithms. We would like the algorithms to like us, which apparently is possible to do.
I'd like to give a shout out, Shayna, to our loyal listeners on the Indian subcontinent.
Yes.
Send us a hello. We would love for you to introduce yourself to us so that we can say hello back. Well, I guess we just said hello, but maybe a little more personally of a hello.
I'm just so excited that, you know, to have an international audience. Very exciting.
Before we get to our playful randomness with the spinny wheel, Shayna, I did want to ask you, last show, I just treasured our conversation, and I do recommend listeners, if you didn't, to go back and listen to Shayna talk about her recent adventure to Antarctica. And it was so powerful, and I was reflecting on it, and I just wanted to pause here for a second to see if you wanted to, a week later, if there was anything you wanted to add or any additional reflections that you had.
Chris, honestly, mostly what I wanted to say to you was thank you, because the conversation that we had together allowed me to begin to process that whole trip in a much deeper way, which is what I was sort of hoping would happen. Because, you know, sometimes you just can't do that stuff alone. You need someone who's a good listener, and more to the point, someone who asks good questions, which you always do. So thank you for that. And certainly if our listeners have any questions that they would like to ask, go ahead and just pop them right up there on the Facebook page, and we will get back to you.
You're welcome, and thank you for the conversation last week. We like to inject a playful randomness into our show, and one way we do that is we spin a wheel, and it lands on a key value or core idea, and we do a little riff on it. So randomness and randomness.
It's our version of Stump the Chump, right? Chris, it's been so long, I have no idea whose turn it is to spin.
May I give you the honor?
You may. I would gladly take it.
The spinny wheel has landed on plural, one of our key concepts and core ideas. Plurality, and the feature of our shared common life here in the United States. I know you have often a different riff, but that's where I go on the concept of plurality and the necessity to steer our way between the programmatic secularists and the quasi-theocrats. That there is a space for a religious, spiritual, grounded voice, and it can't be the only voice. I mean, that's one kind of particular instance of how plurality in our shared common life can express itself.
Well, and if we're seeking to be godly, or if we are seeking to be organic, another way to look at that. You know, there is not one kind of tree out there. There is not one kind of bird out there. There is not one kind of fish out there. Human beings come in many different shapes, sizes, colors, and abilities. We speak different languages. So, you know, pluralism is the organic nature of things. And when we go against that, we get into trouble, right? We're at crosshairs and things start breaking down. I would just add on the political side of the spectrum that I believe, you know, pluralism is to democracy what breath is to humanity, that you cannot have a democracy without a body of people who can hold multiple ideas at the same time. And the struggles that we're experiencing right now in our nation, I think, are so much a result of people getting so entrenched into this or that. You know, you are this or that. You are on this side or that side. And that's going to be counterproductive to democracy as we have known it.
You having said that makes me want to do a whole show right now on pluralism and plurality.
Well, let's put it on the list.
You know, one day we should just spin the wheel and then do the rest of the show on where it lands.
We could do that. They're great. You picked some great topics, some great core ideals.
But not today. That is not our show today. We are beginning a mini-series on mental health and the pandemic, very broadly understood. Mental health in our society, a different way to slice it. So not just this individualized, introspective look at mental health, which is important, and we will cover that. But mental health in our society, what deeper stories can we tell about our shared common life together? Given all the signs of mental and spiritual and moral distress and disease in our culture. And so we're going to approach this in this mini-series with a bifocal, if not more, but at least a bifocal vision, the individual and the collective.
Fascinating.
Shana, just to set some context, I want to quote Andrew Sullivan. He's got a Substack newsletter. He says the core activities, this is his reflection on pandemic time, the core activities that help us become functional citizens and happy humans, the daily physical interaction with the actual faces and bodies of other people, dialogue, conversation, laughter, surprise, and the practice of self-restraint have been winnowed, he says. We have less sex and watch more porn. We have more friends, in quotation marks, but fewer friendships. We marry less and have fewer children. We turn inward before we turn outward in every spare moment we have, gazing into the black mirror, he says, alone together. Facebook is now pushing us toward the metaverse. It is in this cheerful mood that I read a new book by an old friend, Johann Hari. It's called Stolen Focus. Like his previous books, his new book diagnoses most of us as sane and the culture we live in as mad. And I'm just going to pause on this. There's one more paragraph I want to read, but I love that sentence. And it's something I've said on this show before, that if you are, if you are awake and alive to the madness of the culture, then you will, in some ways, be crazy yourself. And to be maladjusted to a crazy culture is a sign of health. So Andrew Sullivan goes on to say, the core thesis is this: create a throwaway consumerist civilization, break families into ever smaller units, add a tech revolution, online addiction, economic precariousness, breakneck social change, endless work, and the collapse of religion and meaning, and yes, people will go a bit nuts. They'll become depressed. They'll seek out escapes through opiates or meth. They'll disappear down rabbit holes of online fanaticism. They'll seek meaning through work or fame. They'll tear each other down with glee. They'll lose the skills for family, friendship, constancy, discipline, and love.
Fade to black.
Yeah. So it's certainly a bleak picture, but it is a bleak picture. It's not the entire picture, but it is a bleakness that I think is simply real.
Yeah. I hear it in some respects as being extraordinarily liberating. You know, like, okay, all right, good, great, it's far out. You know, I am not a crazy person. This is really happening. And I think I'm not alone. I think there's a lot of people who are feeling, though, just the sheer weight of it just drags us down morally and emotionally and drags us under in so many ways. To have somebody come along and say, you're not crazy, but the system you're living in absolutely is, I think most people would be like, yeah, yeah, you know, for sure. But I do like the way he identifies the parts of it. The one part that I think he missed, unless I missed hearing it, was what we in trauma circles call administrative betrayal, which is in this context, how those in positions of power, elected officials, have misused and abused their power outright, have gone against, you know, some of the very foundations of our democracy, so that we don't even have that image of America and American democracy to clutch back onto, something to, you know, to lift us up. And, you know, what he's saying about religion is also true in the sense that so few people these days do identify as religious. Though, that having been said, unless you want to respond to that first.
I do want to just respond to that first very briefly by saying, because you're, of course, elegantly making this transition, we want to focus in on trauma today as one, as not the entire story of the mental health of our shared common life, but it's certainly a piece of it. And it's really part of what I'm attracted to in this conversation with you is that in your work as a chaplain, as you're, even before you were studying in divinity school, your work as a paramedic, you have experienced, you've lived into this issue of trauma. Before you go further, though, can you say that phrase again? Administrative what?
Administrative betrayal. So we talk about when we're working with first responders post-critical incident, we talk about what makes a traumatic incident traumatic, because the basic definition of a traumatic event is an abnormal set of circumstances which overwhelms an individual's normal coping mechanisms. We all have coping mechanisms, and they have limitations. And when we, you know, exceed the limitations of those coping mechanisms, the result can be the experience of trauma. When you're dealing with first responders, you're not dealing with people who have normal coping mechanisms. You're dealing with people who have superhuman coping mechanisms. If they didn't, they couldn't do the work that they do. So we've identified certain things that make something that sort of ensure that the incident is going to go right to the top, you know, of the trauma chain. Things like any time a child is involved, that is going to be a traumatic incident. Any time a responder or responders know the victim, that is going to be a traumatic incident. And administrative betrayal is a situation, sadly, too common in our ranks of first responders, where the very people who are put in place to support a group of people doing their job have in some way acted to undermine it.
Can I just say, that is brilliant. Like, that's brilliant. What a brilliant insight and a brilliant phrase. So, yeah, so it's the failure of leadership that should know better.
When leadership fails to lead morally, ethically, and actually, that undermines the sense of safety.
Safety, exactly.
Really.
Yeah.
And you don't want you really do not want a bunch of people running around who don't feel safe. And I think that is, I mean, my God, you know, we have this pandemic that's out there. And now we've been living in a pandemic for what? We're coming on 3 years. This, I mean, it's 2 years. In February, it's 2 years.
Correct.
We begin our third year in March. And yeah, I think people are feeling unsafe. And I think given Maslow's pyramid, you can't, you know, you can't have a bunch of people who are feeling functionally unsafe and hope to have a functioning society.
Right. Tell me more about trauma.
I think that, you know, when we talk about post-traumatic stress response, which is, you know, a phrase most of our listeners will be familiar with, or maybe you've heard it called post-traumatic stress disorder. I don't call it post-traumatic stress disorder. I call it post-traumatic stress response. And the reason I do that is because nobody has ever been able to explain to me what a normal response to an abnormal set of circumstances is. So yeah, if you encounter an abnormal set of circumstances, you're going to have an abnormal response to that. It doesn't really become PTSD, okay, until there is a criteria. I'm going to go into the whole clinical thing, but there is a criteria for when something becomes post-traumatic stress disorder. And that only really happens to 3% of the people. So if you take a mass group of people who all have encountered the same thing, let's say a workplace shooting, for example, only 3% of those people are really going to struggle. The rest of the people are going to struggle some, and with a little help, this event will build some resiliency. It will actually make them stronger. We actually have a whole new branch of study in trauma called post-traumatic growth, which is a fascinating field in and of itself.
Shana, let me ask you this. I want to ask you about the growth part, the post-traumatic growth. And can you help me understand, help us understand when that is happening? How do we know that the originative experience that blows us apart is being somehow reassembled into some maybe new whole? I don't even know if that's the right metaphor or image, but just this concept of post-traumatic growth.
That's a really great question, Chris. And I imagine it depends a lot on the individual and the incident, but I'd say it probably starts with realizing we still have a pulse and we're still breathing. And that may sound very simplistic, but I'm talking about trauma here. I'm talking about something that literally blows your life apart, where you lose breath, where your insides feel like they're caving in on themselves. And you literally can't make sense of what's happening around you, either for a moment or for an extended period of time. And everything you thought was so about the world is suddenly called into question, which dovetails very nicely with a lot of what we're talking about today, right? That all of that stuff is called into question. I think it's really different for different people. Again, I think maybe it's like the moment you notice the trees again, or the moment you hear the bird song. You first have to realize that you're still here and that life is going on. Then there's a whole process of making meaning out of whatever happened. So we've seen time and time again, parents who lose a child set up a fund, or, you know, the child loved fishing. So there's a fishing thing that happens every spring that's a fundraiser for the leukemia that killed this kid. You know, whatever it is, people make meaning out of it. And so they've taken the thing which could have undone them and they've integrated it and made something of it. Does that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think those rituals are really important. I mean, I do think the making something of it is important, because, you know, I'm just thinking back on my own brother's suicide. And it was a year or so after he had taken his life where I had an opportunity to sign up for a suicide prevention training program. And I did. I took the training, and I have trained some people in suicide awareness and prevention. So that is sort of how I made sense. That was my thing of how I made sense of that trauma in my life. And that was very helpful.
That's really interesting to me on a lot of levels. But one thing I've been reflecting on with trauma, my own reading of it, my own experience of it, my own knowledge of it in my work, one feature can be kind of a disordered sense of time. What I mean by that is, of course, the traumatic experience we know about intrusive thoughts. So the past keeps getting drawn into the present. So the past is not in the past. It's just coming before you. So that element of the past becoming present, and then a sense of not having hopefulness for the future, like somehow we're trapped in this eternal past and have difficulty releasing ourselves in openness to the future, to a hopeful future. And your example, what you're talking about doing the suicide awareness and being able then to be helpful to other people is, to me, an example of being able to move into the future.
PTSD is when the past doesn't stay in the past. It shows up in the present, and it shows up in the present in a way where we can't distinguish that past event is not actually happening right now. And that's different. You can have, after a traumatic event, you can have intrusive images and intrusive thoughts. It's part of the process of your brain trying to make sense of everything. That in and of itself isn't post-traumatic stress disorder. That is your brain trying to work it out. But when you can't even think about the event or talk about the event without getting thrown back into it as if it's happening all over again. So if I'm, we had a terrible motor vehicle accident involving all of these cars, and they blew up and they were on fire, and the smell of, smoke and the sound of people screaming and the feel, the heat of the fire. Now, if I'm telling you the story about the car wreck and I start to experience all of that again, I can literally taste the smell of the burning gas in my mouth. I start to break out in a sweat. I'm actually reliving the event. That's post-traumatic stress disorder. That is a whole different level of hurt. And fortunately, we know how to address that, and we can help people address that. But that is a whole different level of, it's a whole different level of hurt.
I want to let our listeners know that we'll have more of this kind of conversation in an interview with Leslie Rawlings, who does trauma therapy with people, with her clients. And she's based in New Jersey, and Shana and I had an interview with her. That'll be playing as part of this series. Shana, as we come to a close, towards a close, I am wanting to ask you and to raise for us the question of, okay, how does our understanding of trauma, can we see how that fits in a story of where we are collectively today? And maybe there's no, maybe that seems a hard question to me because I don't know what the answer is. But also then to connect it, like I'm sitting here thinking, are there biblical stories? I mean, there is lots of trauma, a lot of communal trauma in the history of the Israelites and how they managed and coped. Any thoughts about, I'm asking you this question so I can listen to you and then try to give myself a little more time to think about it.
Well,
are we today?
I'm not one for, cheesy, easy answers, but what I know from Scripture and what I know from my own life is that what usually follows the breakdown is the breakthrough. The fact that getting through that requires a little bit of faith in something, you gotta have faith in something. For our first responders, obviously, I'm always hoping when we go in to do our debriefings, with them following a traumatic event, that they're gonna have some faith in us and they're gonna have some faith in this process, which has been around for a long time and which has proven to be very effective, which is why I usually sell that process up front. You know, here's the process, here's what we're going to do, here's why it works, to get them invested and believing that this process can help. You got to have faith in something. You've got to know on some level, either from personal experience or from stories of people who have come before us, and certainly scripture has no shortage of these, that the thing that follows the breakdown is renewal, is rebirth, not in the same form as the thing was before, in a new form. Those of us who are, those of us who are religious will say, you know, we're always paying attention to that. Is it Amos? God doing a new thing? You know, God is always doing a new thing. In nature, nothing is standing still. Everything is either evolving or decaying. Take your pick. Nothing stands still in nature, and neither do we. So this is probably just as horrible as it feels to be in the midst of it, and when your world is blowing apart, you don't know what's coming next and what you can trust, and all of the old things are passing away, to have faith that something new is coming into being.
I'm thinking of the phrase, life yearning for life.
Mm.
So I'm seeing
what is
this,
the saying?
Life yearning for life. And to me, what that encapsulates is that there is even a biological, a deep, it's hard to not get theological, but there's something imprinted in life that wants to be alive. And I mean, it gets back to the Andrew Sullivan.
Jesus, we could do a whole show on this. Like, my head just exploded, I think. But
life yearning for life, like embedded, imprinted in all of life is the desire to be alive. And so all of, like, the traumatic response, the mental health response, like feeling crazy in a crazy world, is an example of life yearning for life because it knows that this is not the way life should be.
This is not life-giving.
And the trauma response is similar.
Yeah.
We know it to be heavy and hard, but its purpose is to get us to be alive again.
Well, I don't claim, I have no understanding of what its purpose is. I just know that you're right, and that, yes, that's why all of this is so crazy-making. And there's a part of me that kind of wants to say, you know, go bathe in the waters of insanity, in a sense. You know, your insanity is the affirmation that you are alive, and that this is wrong, and that you do still know what is right and what is life-giving. And then emerge from those waters renewed and go forth to do what it is life calls you to do in the face of all this mishigas, which is a Yiddish word for crazy making shit that is totally unnecessary. Love that word.
Be curious, Shana.
Go deep, Chris.
And shine light. Our show today is brought to you by our generous donors on Patreon. We shout out to our generous donors with a huge thank you. Join our generous donors on Patreon. Be part of What in God's Name. Go to patreon.com. You can sign up to get our newsletter at our website, whatingods.com, which is Shana,
WHATINGODS.
And we welcome a special new corporate sponsor today. Shana's got the read.
Chris, our new corporate sponsorship today, Solution Aversion Associates. When life's problems can only be fixed by changing your lifestyle and you simply don't want to, we can help. We are Solution Aversion Associates. We offer enough alternative facts to help you go on living just as you always have, because we know denial is underrated. So don't let reality get in your way. Call Solution Aversion Associates today at 1-800-WHO-CARES. That number again, 1-800-WHO-CARES. One more time, 1-800-WHO-CARES. Don't delay. Call it today. Operators are standing by.
Shana, I'm going to go call immediately after we're done with this show. I'm going to call Solution Aversion Associates. Sounds like like right up my alley.
Yeah, it could be.
Great to be with you, Shayna.
Always great to be with you, Chris. Have a good week.